You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Gemma Goddard. As we continue to cover the coronavirus pandemic, we know many of you have questions and concerns, and here at Idaho Matters, we want to answer those questions with facts. And the best way to do that is to bring in Idaho medical experts. Joining us today, Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. Thanks for coming back, Dr. Pate.
Oh, you're welcome, Samantha. Great to be with you.
So on Monday, the city of Boise made masks optional. Yesterday, it was the Boise School District. They went to mask optional status. Boise State University and Idaho's other colleges are also dropping mask requirements. So I guess the question for you, Dr. Pate, is COVID over now?
I wish. I wish it was over. It's not. If we can look around the world and certainly see that this first wave of worldwide wave, really, of one subvariant of Omicron, it does seem to be kind of wrapping up as it is here in the United States and as it is here in Idaho. But we still see some other countries that are kind of on fire and with a different subvariant of Omicron. And then, of course, we don't know what future variants are coming our way. And while I understand everybody is getting rid of more and more of the precautions and public health measures, and I get it, I understand, but we have to understand that the more that the world allows this virus to transmit unrestrained, the more variants we are going to see. So no, it's not over.
All right, very good. You know, I've been hearing from a lot of people very happy to get rid of masks in Boise, whether it's on the college campus or, you know, in a store or wherever. And as soon as requirements were lifted, depending on where they were, they took the masks off, no more masks. But I've also heard from people who say, like you said, COVID is still out there and it's still contagious. And they're trying to they say, protect themselves. So who's right?
Well, I think that, you know, there's both points of view. But I fear that part of the point of view of those that, you know, we don't need to worry about COVID is because no one is doing a very good job of explaining to people the risks of getting infected, the long-term risks. So certainly, if you look here in Idaho, our transmission rates are still in the accelerated community spread level, even though they're coming down. And so, you know, we've experienced this every single surge. We're on our way down and people say, you know, oh joy, it's all over. And yet, you know, people still get infected on the way down. And then, of course, every one of the prior surges has been followed by another one. So, and if you look at across the United States, we still have a lot of people in hospitals. It's less, but we still do. And we still have a lot of people dying. So those that, like myself, perceive themselves to be at higher risk, I think they're still anxious about this and taking precautions. My fear is that those that think they are at low risk may not actually be at low risk. They may inadvertently infect someone who truly is at higher risk, and they may have given little, if any, contemplation to the fact that they might be very well unlikely to die, but might have significant health challenges going forward.
Exactly. And we're actually going to talk about long COVID and long haulers coming up in the second half of the show, including some really scary stuff that's come out recently. But I want to talk about what you just said about folks who are at higher risk of getting COVID and getting a worse case of COVID. I think there was a lot of people saw Omicron as a milder version. Maybe they experienced it that way. But if someone is, say, older or immunocompromised or has underlying health conditions, getting COVID is even Omicron doesn't mean they're going to get a mild case. They're more likely to get a case that could be extremely serious. Is that correct?
I think some of the narrative about Omicron being milder is a bit unfortunate because people ran with that a bit more than they should have. Let's be clear, milder compared to Delta, which was really, really bad. And so, milder is good, but milder is a description of the disease in a large population. And like anything else, there's a lot of variation within that population. And so, yes, while certainly there is some reason to believe Omicron was milder in general than Delta, there were still many people that ended up hospitalized. Ended up in our ICUs. You remember that our latest crisis standards of care was during Omicron, when our hospitals got overwhelmed,
That's right.
and people still died from it. So, and of course, this has been true about this virus from the beginning. We'll remember the discussions in 2020. COVID is mild. COVID is like a cold. COVID is like a flu. And certainly for some people, it is. But there are many others for which this was way worse, ended up putting them in the hospital, ended up putting them on a breathing machine, and in many unfortunate cases, took their lives. I think the thing that has changed the most since 2020 to now is that in 2020, it was very easy to predict who was high risk, who was likely to end up with severe disease in the hospital dying. That is no longer the case. Yes, we certainly do know people that are at higher risk. What has become much more challenging is to identify those kids that will end up very, very sick because we've had more kids in hospitalization in hospitals over the past 6 months than we did at the beginning. How do you predict which kids those are? You can't really. And also we've had many more young, middle-aged adults, 30s and 40s, in the hospital, and even some that have died. And in some cases, their only risk factor was that they were a little overweight. In other cases, we have no idea why they got so sick. Now, we are learning more. We are starting to understand that there are many genetic influences in what happens, that we're starting to begin to understand a little bit more, but we are far from being able to take Joe or Sally and tell them ahead of time, oh, don't worry if you get infected, you'll be mild. Or, hey, you need to be careful because you'll get severely ill. We can't do that at this time.
That's just scary. When you.
Well, it is.
Wow.
And that's why we've taken this approach, Samantha, that we need to protect everyone because we don't know. And I think that has been one of the big, I think it's been a big lesson for us that I think before this pandemic, we thought people will gladly make a sacrifice that is a mere inconvenience. You know, we're not asking them to give us a bunch of money. We're not asking them to donate a kidney. But yes, people will wear a mask when they're indoors or close to people that they don't live with. People will wear a mask to protect others because of the fact that we don't know who's infected and we don't know who's at very high risk. What we found out is, well, that was not generally true. Certainly there's many that were willing to do that, but it was a far cry from everybody being willing to do so. And I think for many of us, myself included, we thought, well, but schools, they'll protect their children and they'll protect particularly the vulnerable children, which there are many in our schools that are in special education, that have disabilities, that have special needs. And yet we saw very little interest. In fact, what we saw from many schools was the comment, well, if you're scared, and they kind of make it pejorative on these people, if you're scared, then you can just do online learning. Of course, none of these people that were saying that were ones that would want to do online education themselves. But we decided that if you're at risk or vulnerable, then what you should do is you should stay home and lock yourself up. It is for older people, and just don't go to the grocery store. Don't go to the hair salon. Don't go see your family. Just stay locked up in your house if you're old. And if you're a kid and you are disabled, well, you got to just stay home and do school online. So I think, you know, we have a lot of self-reflection to do.
I would agree 100%. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna I'm gonna ask you a little bit more about the variant that you mentioned. It's called BA2. It's also known as the stealth variant, and we'll have more on that in just a minute. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Jim Agudette, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Jim Agudette. Continuing our doctor roundtable today with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of Idaho's Coronavirus Task Force. Okay, Dr. Pate, let's talk about BA2. What is it?
So when we talk about Omicron, Omicron has, if I could use the analogy, it has a number of cousins in its family. And so with Omicron, we have BA1, BA1.1, BA2, BA3. And so what we have experienced is BA1. That's what we just went through and we're on the downhill side of. Generally, subvariants aren't a particular concern to us because they're like first cousins. So they're so closely related that you know, the body, it can kind of tell, and it's not a particular threat if you get exposed to more than one subvariant. In this case, these are like, if I can use the slang, brothers from another mother. I mean, even though they're in the same family, they are really, really different. And in fact, the difference between BA1 that we just went through and BA2, which is causing some problems in Europe and in Asia, some real problems, the differences between those two can be greater than the difference between our original virus and Alpha. It's that different, even though they're related. So this is a problem because of several things. One is that it is possible that our immune reactions won't be as good. So the good news is, so far, it does appear that if you're fully vaccinated and boosted, you have pretty good protection against both BA1 and BA2. there is a question about whether you can get BA1 and be recovering from that and then get infected by BA2. It appears the answer is yes, but not commonly. And that those that do get reinfected are the ones that tended to have a mild BA1, which of course is most people. So one of the concerns is that even though we just had this wave of BA1, could we have a wave of BA2? And I think the answer is yes, we could. I just don't know if we will. And the reason I say yes, we could is we have seen that. And we have seen it in other countries. Denmark is probably the best example, but we're seeing it play out in Hong Kong right now. Hong Kong is, their medical system is completely overwhelmed. Their morgues are overwhelmed. But Hong Kong has a different problem for us. Their problem is, while they have about the same vaccination rate as the United States, they have about 70%. Fully vaccinated. Their elderly have been very distrustful of the state, very distrustful of the vaccine. And so while in the United States, we tend to have more of our elderly vaccinated, it's the reverse in Hong Kong. And unfortunately, what we do know is that older people are going to do worse. And so they're having a real problem right now, and also having a spike in now people wanting to get vaccinated. Of course, it's a little bit late when you're going through the surge. So what's happening in the United States? Well, if you go back to February 5th, BA2 was about 1% of all the sequences that we have done. If you look at March 5th, so 1 month, it is now on average 11.6%. But that is an average across the country. If you break down the country, there are places, particularly in the South and in the Midwest, that are lower. But the highest place of frequency of detecting BA2 on sequencing is actually the upper Northeast. The Northwest, which is Washington, Oregon, Idaho, even though we haven't found much in Idaho, when you look at that whole area, it's about 14.9%. So it's higher than the average. Ooh. So what I tell people is, if you want to get an early warning sign, if BA2 is going to cause us a problem, watch New York and New Jersey over the next 2 to 3 weeks. That, I think, will be the canary in the coal mine.
Well, I noticed this morning there were some stories about it spreading rapidly in New York, just as they're lifting mandates there. But I want to ask two quick questions about BA2. It's called the stealth variant at times because it doesn't always show up on COVID tests, I believe. And then it may have different symptoms at times than Omicron. Are both of those true statements?
Not exactly. So the reference to it being stealth is, we were able to identify Omicron cases that we had in the United States, which were BA1, without sequencing, because what happens is it, when we do, everybody knows what a PCR test is by now. When we do that test, we're generally checking for like four different kinds of identification. So like, we're going to look at your fingerprints. We're going to look at your facial recognition. You know, we're going to look at your height, you know, and so this test can look and see, do you match up on all four of these things, which would tell us, yeah, this is a positive test. Omicron, the BA1 that we just went through, one of those didn't show up because it was a different. So in other words, when you were checking identification on this test, it would give you like three positives, one negative. So that actually stood out. And so even without sequencing, we could pretty much tell from the lab test, oh, this is Omicron, because Delta, which we were just coming out of, would have tested positive on all four. BA1 we could see because it was only testing on three, BA2 tests on all four. So it does get picked up by the test, but it doesn't stand out like the BA1 did. And generally, I don't think we have enough evidence right now to say that it really is all that much different. With BA1, which is Omicron, which we just went through, one thing that we did notice is that people tended to have much more of like an upper respiratory infection than the pneumonias that we saw with Delta. I'm certainly hearing reports from other countries that they are now seeing BA2 look a lot more like Delta did, and that people are getting pneumonias, are getting oxygen needs, ventilator needs, and so forth, more than maybe what we saw with BA1. But we don't have any clear or convincing evidence that BA2 causes more severe disease than BA1. I think that the jury's out on that one.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm going to thank you, Dr. Pate, because we are going to jump from the Dr. Roundtable to long COVID here for the next two segments. And I want to thank you for everything that you have been doing for us over the past, I don't even want to say how long, a couple of years now.
Yes. Well, thank you, Samantha. It's been a pleasure.
And we'll have you back next week. We'll be talking more. If you have questions for our Dr. Roundtable, please send them to us. BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. You can pick a way to get us there, or you can send it to our email. It's idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Our thanks again to Dr. Pate, the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System. And we'll see you next week.
See you then.
All right. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Jim Agudat. You're listening to Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Jim Agudat. As we continue to talk about the coronavirus on Idaho Matters, we want to turn our attention today to long COVID. Those are the symptoms that can stick around after you've had COVID-19. And with us today to talk about long COVID is Dr. Ryan Williams, the medical director for Direct COVID Care, a monoclonal antibody clinic in Boise and a hospitalist at St. Alphonsus in Boise. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Williams.
Thank you, Samantha. Good to be back.
And, you know, we wanted to have you back on because last week when you were on the Doctor's Roundtable, you talked a bit about long COVID, and we got some really good response, and we figured out that a lot of people have been asking us about long COVID and long haulers, as they're also known. So let's just jump right in. What is long COVID? Give us a definition.
Okay, great. Yeah, thanks so much, Samantha. So long COVID, its name and its definition has been shifting over the last several years that we've started to see these kind of symptoms. But it can be known by post-COVID condition, post-acute SARS-CoV-2 condition, and then, of course, the long COVID. And that long COVID caught on by a Twitter response in the year 2020, when patients started to kind of experience symptoms several weeks after their initial COVID infection. And so it initially started to, the definition was 4 weeks after your initial infection. If you continue to have symptoms, then you could have this post-COVID condition. And now the definition has changed a little bit, and it's roughly, you know, greater than 8 weeks after your initial infection to greater than 12 weeks, and usually symptoms lasting for greater than 2 months. So we start seeing these definitions of long COVID and post-COVID condition used in a lot more research papers. So that's kind of an overview of the definitions of long COVID.
So what are some of the symptoms of of long COVID. I think the one we've heard a lot about is loss of taste or smell, but there are a lot of these, right?
Oh yeah, the symptoms can vary greatly. Probably the majority of patients that suffer from long COVID tend to have significant fatigue. They do have the they can have the loss of taste and smell. They can have a kind of depression, anxiety. Certainly, the brain fog that's associated with some memory issues, cognitive decline. So we call it loss of executive function, where patients that used to be able to kind of be pretty quick on their feet, so to speak, with their mentation, have a more difficult time. They may have a tougher time doing their job, especially if they're kind of high demand mental function jobs. And then you can have symptoms of cardiac nature. So you can have increased heart rate. You can have what we call orthostatic hypotension, where you stand up and you get real lightheaded and you fatigue really easily. So the symptoms can vary, vary greatly.
Well, we got a question from Leslie last week. My exposure to COVID resulted in tachycardia, she says, for weeks, pounding heart all night, having to lay down even during doing yoga. Her blood pressure was weird. She said she's seen this happening to many women who have had COVID. Now, apparently there is a name for this. You have told me that this is a thing.
Yeah, this is a thing. And, you know, I'm glad she mentioned the predominance of women experiencing this. You know, we've seen that COVID, it seemed that that men were affected more proportionally with severe COVID initially. So acute COVID symptoms, men seem to have more severe disease than women on average. But that's not the case with long COVID. It seems that women around the age of 40 or 40 to 50 seem to have a higher risk of post-COVID condition or long COVID. And the symptoms that she's reporting actually do have a name. It's called postural tachycardia syndrome. And we think it's an issue of the autonomic nervous system being dysregulated. So typically when someone stands up, goes from laying, sitting to standing, your blood pressure and your heart rate can adjust very quickly in order for you to not get lightheaded so that blood doesn't stop rushing to your brain. But in this postural tachycardia syndrome, that system is off kilter. And patients can have exactly what she experienced. High heart rate, so tachycardia, lack of, they can have balance issues. So when they stand up, they get lightheaded. And then just they could have sweating episodes. A lot of different symptoms that are associated with this tachycardia syndrome.
That too is scary. I seem to be saying that a lot today. So you mentioned women in their 40s for this. And I wanted to ask about that. Who gets long COVID? Is there a criteria that we can point to that you can say this person had this COVID and they're going to get long COVID symptoms?
Yeah, this is the kind of the million-dollar question. And there does not seem to be a strong correlation between severity of initial COVID illness and risk of long COVID. Certainly with some conditions like if you were in the ICU because of respiratory failure, you may have long-term use of oxygen and some pulmonary symptoms. But for the brain and the autonomic dysfunction, there does not seem to be a strong correlation between severity of the illness and long COVID. So you can have mild disease, so mild COVID symptoms or even asymptomatic COVID and or relatively asymptomatic COVID, so mild symptoms, and still suffer from chronic fatigue and these, you know, brain fog and several of these other symptoms.
Well, if we don't know who is going to get the symptoms, then maybe that's the answer to my second question, which is, why does one person have one symptom and another person have another, like the sense of smell versus somebody who maybe has the tachycardia?
No, it's we don't really know the answer to that, I don't think. At least I don't know the answer. We do know this though, that roughly, so we know the demographics. So like I said, the women between the ages of 40 and 50 seem to be at higher risk of having long COVID. And they're also at risk of having autoimmune diseases. So I think there's a correlation there. We do know that roughly 10 to 30% of all patients that have had COVID can experience long COVID symptoms. We also know that vaccines do help decrease your risk of long COVID. So if you've had the vaccine and you get COVID, which we've seen a number of patients that have been vaccinated but have breakthrough COVID infections, they seem to have a decreased risk of long COVID, roughly about 50% in some studies. And I think the, you know, something I have to stress, Samantha, is that, you know, this is a real condition. You're not crazy. You're not just depressed or just anxious or just stressed. And I think the validation of it is really important. So this is a condition that several people are suffering from, and there is this correlation, but we don't have all the answers yet.
Well, I guess if you want proof maybe of the fact that this is real, I want to talk about this study, and a lot of people are talking about it. It's by the University of Oxford. It was published this week in the journal Nature. And in the study, researchers took brain scans of people before and after that they had a mild case of COVID-19. So they found out that even 5 months after a COVID diagnosis, their scans showed brain damage and sometimes a loss of gray matter. So parts of their brain actually shrunk. And this sounds, once again, really scary, Dr. Williams. If our brains can be damaged by a mild case of COVID.
Yeah, this is a remarkable study, Samantha. So this was done in Britain, so United Kingdom. And I guess one of the benefits of having a government-sponsored healthcare system is you can look at large populations of patients, and they didn't design this study to look at the brain, but they were able to pick out roughly 400 patients that had COVID. Those patients had had brain scans pre-COVID infection. And then they brought them back in, like you said, about 5 months on average, and they rescanned their brain. And they found that there was a decrease in the gray matter and several areas of the brain, part of the prefrontal cortex, some of the other areas, the parahippocampus, hippocampal gyrus, and the insula area were atrophied or had shrunk. Why that is, we don't know exactly why, but there is a correlation between COVID and loss of brain tissue in a way. And this could explain a lot of the neurologic symptoms that we see with long COVID. So some of the brain fog, like we talked about, the chronic fatigue, the mental fog that's associated with long COVID.
And I noticed in the study, they talked about a lot of the scans showed that there had been some kind of damage to the area of the brain where our sense of smell comes from.
Right. That's right. And we, you know, there's obviously a correlation between the lack of sense of smell and then the actual brain findings. So the question is whether it's if the cells in the nose were damaged, causing lack of smell, and then atrophy or because of the loss of function, the neurons shrunk, or it's the actual COVID virus causing damage to the neurons of the brain. And we can't know exactly the cause and effect, you know, chicken or the egg there, but there is that association.
Well, and do we know if our brains can come back from this kind of damage, or is it, you know, too soon to tell?
Yeah, I don't know if I know. Here's what we do know. We know that the brain is an amazing organ, and there's a term called neuroplasticity. So even in stroke patients that have profound deficits, they can regain a lot of their function because the brain is plastic in a way. It can mold, it can change, it can recuperate. Whether we can regain the growth of that gray matter that was lost, I don't know. And I think the study is planning on doing it a third brain scan for many of these patients down the line to see if there's either further brain tissue loss or if there's regain of brain function, brain tissue at least. But we know that the brain is an amazing organ, and I would not lose hope if you have long COVID symptoms, if you know what I mean.
I do. We're going to come back in just a minute, talk a little bit more about symptoms of long COVID. That's coming up in just a minute. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Jim Agudat. You are listening to Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Jim Agudat. Let's continue our focus on long COVID today with Dr. Ryan Williams, the medical director for Direct COVID Care. It's a monoclonal antibody clinic in Boise, who also manages several skilled nursing facilities throughout the Treasure Valley. And Dr. Williams, I want to get a little personal. Can we talk a little bit about your story with COVID-19? When did you have it?
Yes, thank you, Samantha. So it was roughly July of 2020, so pre-vaccine. My wife and I and our four little kids had decided to take a camping trip, a hiking trip up in the McCall area. And we hike up roughly three miles to this little lake, Louis Lake, and my wife spikes a fever. And we make camp, it's kind of getting dark, and she's like down. And we had to get her back down the next day. So we kind of redistributed her pack and hiked down the mountain. My kids were troopers, and my wife made it down. So the next day got her tested, and sure enough, she was positive. And about 4 or 5 days later, I started to have symptoms and also tested positive. You know, Samantha, I thought I was kind of out of the worst of it. And then at about 4 or 5 days of symptoms, I got really sick. The main issue was significant fatigue and just lack of appetite. I could not eat or drink anything. I got kind of dehydrated, went to the ER once, got some IV fluid. But I'll tell you what, the worst part of the whole ordeal was the significant depression that was associated with COVID. At one point, about 3 or 4 weeks in to my symptoms, my wife got me out of the house. I was in the car just looking out the window. And I said, you know, I said, Lacey, if I had the energy and razor blade, I may slip my arms. And she looked at me, and I can't stress how horrible the depression was and how it affected my outlook on life. You know, even that which we use to help us overcome the trials in our life, that mental fortitude was totally gone. And a couple of days later, a few friends started showing up randomly. my wife had called, you know, some of my friends and said, hey, you got to come over and check on Ryan. And eventually I started feeling better. So it was about 5 to 6 weeks I started to recover. But I tell you what, I have a kind of a newfound sympathy and empathy for those that suffer from depression, those that suffer from mental health problems, and the significant fatigue that was associated with COVID. And I was one of the lucky ones. I was able to recover and recovered completely. But you know, the symptoms from that we experience post-COVID of significant fatigue and depression and lack of energy, they're both physically debilitating and mentally debilitating. And they're real. And it's not just in your head. So reach out to those people that you know, depend on, that you rely on, and your healthcare providers.
Definitely reach out for help. I know you were worried that your depression and your fatigue might be long COVID, and worry can't help, you know, the negative thoughts that can come along with depression.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. So, you know, being a provider, being a physician, but also just being a person, you start Googling things, right? And it's like, oh, this could last for months. I can't do this for months. I can't handle this. I have to, you know, provide for a family, and I got to keep working. And, you know, I have my career ahead of me. And so it was really scary. It was really scary looking at, I think at that time they were calling it long haulers, and it was just brand new, as the disease process was just being discovered. There was a lot of unknowns, and although we still have quite a few unknowns, we have a lot of knowns as well. And there's a lot of support mechanisms available. So I think currently, I wanted to plug this before I forget, Samantha, is that St. Luke's has a COVID recovery clinic run by several internal medicine docs. And they use a multi-modality approach for patients that have prolonged complex symptoms associated with COVID-19.
Wow, that is an awesome resource, because we have heard over and over that, you know, without a lot of understanding about long COVID or long haulers, you know, there's, where do you go? What do you do?
Yeah.
And I think it's important. The other thing that I noticed in the minute or two we have left was that if you have some of these long COVID symptoms, I know you and other doctors have said, don't just write it off and say, oh, well, you know, I had COVID, so now I have this, so it's just long COVID, and, you know, I just have to live with it, because it might not be long COVID. It might be something else, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So there's lots of different causes of fatigue. There's different causes of, you know, chronic diarrhea or chronic cough. I know of a patient that, you know, had cough symptoms several weeks and months after his COVID, but he was also on a medication that can cause cough, and the medication was stopped and his cough went away. So don't chalk all your symptoms up to long COVID. Go get checked out. Get the necessary, workup performed. Make sure it's not your thyroid. Make sure it's not anemia from colon cancer, and make sure you do all your screening, appropriate screening for your age and your symptomatology. So don't give up, that's for sure. And sometimes you got to be the squeaky wheel, Samantha. Our poor primary care docs often are overwhelmed, and the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So and then we have this other resource available.
Absolutely. So squeak, everybody, squeak. I want to thank you so much. We've been speaking with Dr. Ryan Williams, the medical director for Direct COVID Care, a monoclonal antibody clinic in Boise, and a hospitalist at St. Alphonse's in Boise. And thank you so much for sharing your experience and telling us about long COVID.
Thank you so much, Samantha.
And thank you so much for listening. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Jim Agudat. You can hear today's program and previous interviews at our website. Just go to boisestatepublicradio.org. We'll be back tomorrow.